Well, good afternoon. We have a full house today. We had a full house this morning, too, but then it was all students. I don't know. On my list, we don't have any students, so we just have a lot of interested members of the public, which is wonderful. We like to have you all come and visit us and see what we do here at the Supreme Court. So I will call our third case of the day. Gabler versus Crime Victim Rights Board. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Misha Zaitlin, Solicitor General, on behalf of the Crime Victims Rights Board. In this case, the Circuit Court erroneously held that a child victim of sexual assault had no meaningful, speedy disposition rights after the guilt phase of the trial because she would be, and I quote, under no greater or less stress having sentencing delayed. The court then delayed sentencing for more than half a year in violation of the victim's rights. This victim, whose constitutional and statutory rights had just been violated by a circuit judge of the state, bravely turned to the only forum available to her.
Why do you say that the court determined she had no rights? Didn't the court interpret the words timely disposition of the case and speedy disposition of the case, one in the Constitution and one in the statute, a particular way that authorized what he did?
Your Honor, the court did adopt a interpretation of the statute and the Constitution. That interpretation, with all due respect, is erroneous and, frankly, not defensible and not really defended in the briefs here. The argument that was made on the January 18th hearing was an argument. The holding that was made by the judge was because the victim had no more responsibilities in the case. She had no speedy disposition
rights. Right, but he was interpreting the Constitution, and he was interpreting a statute, both of which he was fully aware. Don't we usually have appeals if folks don't like the interpretation of a statute or the Constitution, either directly or perhaps by intervention? How did we get to the Victims' Rights Board to reinterpret a statute and a constitutional provision that one of our circuit courts interpreted?
As far as I'm aware, there is no legal mechanism for a victim to challenge the decision that the circuit judge made here. As a result, if the victim's rights board is not available, the door is shut on the victim.
Was there ever any attempt of the victim's rights boards to intervene and to argue that he erroneously interpreted the statute or the constitutional provision?
The Victims' Rights Board has a process which is set out by the legislature.
And that wasn't my question. My question was there any effort made to intervene, to appeal this as an intervener? Which is, you know, if a judge does something and we think the judge interpreted a statute, constitutional provision incorrectly, generally we appeal that, and sometimes the judge is wrong, and that's what the appellate system is for. Was there ever any attempt to intervene by the Victims' Rights Board or anyone on behalf of the victim?
Your Honor, as far as I'm aware, there is no legal mechanism for the board to have intervened.
That's not my question. My question was, did anybody try to do it?
Nobody tried to do it, Your Honor, and the reason for that is, as far as I'm aware, there is no legal mechanism beyond the process that was followed, which is that the victim files an initial complaint with the Office of Crime Victim Services, and then, once that's done, then the victim goes to the board. The board then has a process, and at the end of that process, it has a number of options. It took a lesser option here after finding a violation, which is just issuing a report and recommendation.
But when it found a violation, it reinterpreted the statute the judge interpreted, and it reinterpreted the constitutional provision on timely resolution of the case, or disposition of the case, I think is the word. Right? Didn't the board say that he didn't follow the provisions in the Constitution and in the statute?
That's right, Your Honor.
The board took a statute that our court interpreted and reinterpreted it and said our judge interpreted it wrong, correct?
That's right, Your Honor. Now, let me explain why that is completely consistent with the separation powers.
What the
board did here is it made a decision. It made a decision that the victim's constitutional statutory rights had been violated. And then what it did is it issued a report and recommendation. It didn't overturn a decision. It didn't impose a fine on the judge. It didn't mandate anything. It issued its opinion. And then that opinion is itself appealable under the Chapter 227 process through the courts, all the way up to this court. There is no separation of powers violation when there is no sanction issued on the judge beyond...
You don't think it's a sanction, the report that I read that was issued, that would be in all the newspapers, that Judge Gabler violated the rights of a victim during the course of a proceeding in which he was in charge? You don't think that's a sanction?
The report and recommendation that was issued didn't mention Judge Gabler's name. It was a four-page document that laid out the facts of the case, and it reached the board's determination of whether that was a violation of rights and explained what the best practices would be in the
similar
situation.
So now the Victim Rights Board is supposed to tell courts what best practices are. I thought that it was our job to supervise the lower courts. I thought that's what the Constitution said the Wisconsin Supreme Court was to do.
The Constitution does say that, but it also says that the legislature has authority under the Victim Rights Amendment to determine what the remedies are under that amendment. And I submit...
Counsel, and on that point in particular, what I'd like you to do, if you could, is describe to me the authority that provision of Section 9M gives to the legislature in this particular context. So the CBRB was reviewing Judge Gabler's scheduling of the case, correct?
It was reviewing the way that Judge Gabler had treated the victim's rights complaint that was issued.
All right. Now, the way that Judge Gabler conducts his calendar, that is an aspect of core judicial power, is it not?
That is true, but sometimes it implicates other rights, like constitutional rights of a victim.
Well, I don't want you to get ahead of me here, because there's some steps I want you to lead me through so I can understand what the state's position is on this. So if we're agreed that Judge Gabler was exercising core judicial power when he scheduled the sentencing to occur after the second trial, then the CBRB was reviewing that exercise of discretion, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
For the purpose of determining whether there's a violation of Section 9M?
Among other things, yes.
Okay. So now, so we go to Section 9M, that contains the crime victim's rights, and the provision in there for the speedy disposition of the matter. And then if I'm correct, the source of authority that you're relying on for the CBRB conducting this review is the provision that allows the legislature to create remedies. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there any other source of authority other than that?
I believe that the legislature would have plenary authority to do it if it wanted to.
Yeah, I'm sorry, what?
It would have general plenary authority to do it even without the Victim Rights Amendment, but I believe the Victim Rights Amendment gives a specific authority that makes it clearer.
Okay. So that provision of Section 9M, did that transfer any judicial power to the legislature?
No, Your Honor. What you have in this situation is a mixed powers case. You don't have the discipline and sanction of judges has never been in this court viewed as an exclusive power of the judiciary. It has always been viewed as a mixed power in the judiciary, as this court clearly held in the Seraphim case mentioned at Appendix 202 by the board. So that is a mixed power. So once we're in a mixed power context, the inquiry is, did the board's actions here in this as-applied case, quote, unduly burden or significantly interfere with the judiciary's function? That's
okay.
The legal test.
Right. But let's set aside the mixed power for a second here, because I want to concentrate on what it was the CBRB was reviewing. And that was the exercise of a core judicial function. Is it the state's position that it can take actions collateral to that, that affect and are based on a core judicial function, and that the legislature has the authority to give to the executive to act in a way that would address core judicial functions?
Not exactly, Your Honor. The state's position is when you are in a mixed power case like this, the inquiry for any particular case is whether, especially in this as-applied case, is whether what happened here, does it unduly burden or substantially interfere with that part of that mixed power case that is the judiciary's.
And when the executive is claiming that a judge violated makes findings of fact and conclusions of law that a judge violated someone's constitutional rights, doesn't that substantially affect and interfere with the judge's ability to exercise his core judicial function?
Your Honor, it's not the judge's rights that we're talking about here. It's the judiciary as a whole.
Yes, it is. So we're talking about his exercise of core judicial power. The executive comes along and says, in exercising your core judicial power, Judge Gabler, you violated someone's constitutional rights. Where does the executive get the authority to say that?
From the authority given by the legislature under the Victim Rights Amendment. That's where it gets it.
And other than the CVRB, is there any other circumstance whatsoever in which an executive branch agency has the authority to come and tell a judge that he misused his core judicial power?
I will say the following. I don't know about an executive. I don't have an example. But I do believe that the legislature, under its authority to both impeach judges and to address judges, which is the other way of moving judges, would have the authority to, as a legislative body, announce its opinion that a judge had violated somebody's constitutional rights. I think that would be attendant to that legislative power. So in this case, the legislature had a different power, and it assigned it to the executive, which I think was well within its power. But it is nothing unique about the authority of some other branch to be able to say in its conclusion, in its view, that the Constitution was violated.
Are you relying on the impeachment sections to remove a judge in the Constitution? Is that what you meant when you said the legislature has the authority to impeach a judge?
Justice Kelly asked me, is there any other authority under which an executive could conclude that a judge has violated their rights?
That has nothing to do with this case, does it?
No, my only point, it does have to do with this case.
Well, that's why I want to know, because I was shocked by your answer.
It have to do with this case, Your Honor, because I believe it shows that the authority to sanction judges is not an exclusive authority of this court. And that is exactly what this court
just
held.
Just a minute. What was this? You have to be careful.
Okay.
Be careful. Here's this constitutional provision that says the court has the power to sanction judges under procedures set forth by the legislature. That the court can, and you have the language in front of you, let's just double back, okay? Do people have the right to be critical of court decisions under the First Amendment?
Of course, Your Honor.
Of course. And a president of the United States in a State of the Union speech, I think it was critical of the United States Supreme Court.
Right, I believe Citizens United, I believe, yes.
Pardon me?
Yeah, I believe the Citizens United decision, yes, I believe.
Yeah. And I believe a more recent president has been critical of judges, particularly criticizing particular decisions of the judge, right?
I read that on the news, too, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
I read that on the news, too, Your Honor.
Yeah, I did, too. And they have a First Amendment right to be critical of judges? Are judges above the law?
Yes, Your Honor.
You think judges are above the law?
No, I think that there was a First Amendment right to say that.
Okay. All right. But there is no right to reprimand or discipline a judge unless you do it through procedures set forth by the legislature, and then the ultimate decision is this court. Is that right?
I'm not sure exactly how you frame that question, Your Honor.
Well, I get there through the Constitution. Okay, let's just look at the language that I'm looking at in Article 7. And so you can't do it through a procedure that's not set up in the Constitution. But what was the sanction here? What did the board do to this judge?
The only sanction, and this is very important in this as-applied case.
That's why I asked the
question. The only sanction was a report and recommendation of what, in the board's view, should be done in future cases without naming the judge. That was the only sanction here.
But does the state concede that under the relevant statute, the board has the power to issue a private or a public reprimand.
That is correct.
Could that have been done in this case?
Yes, it could have been. But I will note that that would have been subject to court review up to this court under a Chapter 227 proceeding.
Is this court subject to the powers of the Crime Victim Rights Board?
Let me give two answers for that, Your Honor. One as a legal matter, one as a practical matter. As a legal matter, yes, every state employee is subject, if they violate a victim's rights, to the various procedures in the board. Now, as a practical matter, the board has been operating for 18 years. There has never been a complaint brought at the appellate, at anything that happened at the appellate stage, whether it's an appellate judge or, and that's because most of the victim's rights deal with things that happen at trial.
But if we accept your position, the state does concede that the Crime Victims' Rights Board would have the power to publicly reprimand a justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court if we rendered a decision that, in the board's opinion, violated victims' rights.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And does the state take a position on how long this court should have to render decisions in criminal matters so that we do not offend the Crime Victims' Rights Board?
Your Honor, it's not a perfect analogy, but the speedy trial rights of criminal defendants have been often litigated. And those are, I would say, often even lesser than victims' rights. And there's never been a case that I'm aware of that has held or implied that the time it took for an appellate process to take is a violation of a criminal defendant's speedy trial rights. So I would think that the same would apply to a victim's rights given the particularities of the appellate process.
But that would be that would
just a minute.
It could occur. If we accept the state's position, that is something that could possibly happen lawfully, if we accept your position.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because that decision by the board, if it were to make that such a decision, would be reviewable under a Chapter 227 review. And given the, as far as I'm aware, unanimous precedent that a speedy trial right cannot be violated by the time it takes to appeal, I think it is extremely unlikely, and I would think impossible for that kind of decision to be upheld under Chapter 227 review.
Mr. Saitlin, are you familiar with the case of Bradley versus Fisher from the United States Supreme Court?
Sorry, I'm not, Your Honor.
That's okay. It was written 100 years before this justice was born. But in that case, the court pronounced a general principle of the highest importance to the proper administration of justice, that a judicial officer, in exercising the authority vested in him, shall be free to act upon his own convictions without apprehension of personal consequences to himself, liability to answer to everyone who might feel himself aggrieved by the action of the judge would be inconsistent with the possession of this freedom and would destroy that independence without which no judiciary can be either respectable or useful. My question for you is, how can the judiciary preserve its independence if the legislative and executive branches of government can collude to punish a judge for exercising his constitutional duties?
I want to just be very clear. The only thing the board can do without asking the courts, without asking the courts first, is issue a report recommendation or issue a reprimand. That is then itself reviewable in courts. If they want to seek equitable relief or they want to seek money, they have to ask the courts. So that is not a violation of separation of powers because that gets funneled through the courts. As far as what the board is doing, what it issues a report or recommendation, or when it issues a reprimand, it's saying that its conclusion. It's saying, you know, like the president said, you know, this is about it. It's saying its conclusion after a process. But that conclusion is itself also reviewable for court. And in the mixed power analysis, and especially given that there's a constitutional right involved, that is well within the legislature's authority to grant. And I just want – sorry, go ahead.
This is a perfect segue into Justice Abrahamson's question.
Well, I appreciate your – talking about these things, but I was discussing Article 7, Section 11, which says each justice or judge shall be subject to reprimand. That's the first thing. Censure, which has never been discussed and has never been defined. Suspension, removal for cause or for disability by the Supreme Court, pursuant to procedures established by the legislature. And if you want to reprimand, censure, suspend, remove for cause, or for disability, then it's done by the Supreme Court, because that's what the state constitution says, and the procedures set forth by the legislature, and they did that, and that's why we have a judicial commission. Okay. So that's why I keep saying to you, what did the board do? And you keep saying they issued a report. It doesn't say anything about issuing report in Section 11. It does say reprimand, but they did not reprimand him.
That's correct.
Is that right? So then it doesn't come under Section 11. Now, let's suppose that there was a legislative committee set up on justice, which it probably is, and the legislative committee takes testimony about delays in sentencing and whether victims' rights are being really fully recognized in the court system of Wisconsin. Can the legislature do that?
Of course, Your Honor.
And could there be a legislative council committee that does that? And could they issue a report that would indicate the judges in the following cases took too long and did violate the crime victim under the statute and constitution?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So if that's true, and just because you say it doesn't mean I agree with it, then under this particular, if they have the power, they can delegate it to a committee, can't they, or a board?
They can, Your Honor. And I will say that when Justice Kelly asked me the question of where does the authority come from, that was my second answer, which is the legislature's plenary power. But go ahead, Your Honor.
Well, that's okay. I want you to answer that. They have plenary power to investigate and public policy of doing that. And we're public officials, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
It's hard to for us to say we're defamed, right, unless there's malice.
That's right, Your Honor. But, sorry.
And this is an as-applied, not facial. So although the board may not have the power to reprimand, maybe, under Article 7, 11, that's not what the challenge to this is.
Absolutely. It's a very important point, Your Honor. The board, in its 18 years, has never reprimanded a judge. So given that my friends on the other side has framed this as an as-applied challenge, the issue of reprimand shouldn't properly be considered in this case.
Yeah, I think you made a mistake by even whispering the word, because I think that there's a real problem with that under Section 11 of the Constitution.
Well, Your Honor, if I may, Section 11 was enacted earlier in time than the Victim Rights Amendment. Earlier in time than the Victim Rights Amendment. So the Victim Rights Amendment gives the legislature new power, and the new power includes crafting the best way to deal with victims' rights. And I will note again that it's very important to realize that if this court accepts petitioner's submission, there will be nowhere for victims to go. Nowhere for victims to go when judges of this state violate their rights, but is not violated in a willful way such that it's subject to the jurisdiction of the judicial commission. There are important considerations here with the judiciary, but there are other important considerations of constitutional import, which is victims' rights.
Well, counsel, I'm not sure that it's necessarily the case they'd have nowhere else to go.
Right.
Could they not file a mandamus action if they believe that a judge is acting in such a way that he's violating a clear obligation under the Constitution, file a mandamus action?
Right. Your Honor, I am not aware of that ever happening. I do not believe that a victim has standing to intervene in a case such that they could file a mandamus action. Of course, this court could say that, and then, you know, that would be the law of the state. But I'm not, I've asked around. I'm not aware of any example of that.
Or maybe the legislature could create that remedy as they are given that authority in Section 9F, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So one framing question, and we'll move on. It seems to me that the provision of Section 9M that gives the legislature the authority to create remedies can do one of two things, maybe both. One, create a remedy. For example, say victims have standing to pursue a mandamus action. Or two, maybe that language authorizes the executive branch to administer the remedies that it creates, or maybe it does both. What is the state's position on that? Is it to create remedies? Is it to authorize the executive branch to administer those remedies, or is it both?
Your Honor, whatever the legislature chooses within reason. The legislature is vested with an authority, and having that kind of specific vesting of authority gives the vested power a significant leeway in what to do.
All right. So if we were to read this in a way that perhaps some of us might be inclined to do, to say that the separation of powers precludes the executive branch from making a judgment on whether a judicial officer has appropriately exercised his core judicial power, couldn't we say it's the legislature's responsibility to come up with a basis of a remedy that could be brought to court in the normal course of proceedings to be considered under the normal judicial framework?
That would, of course, be this court's authority. I think that would be a grave mistake.
Go ahead.
The people, in enacting the Victims' Rights Amendment, designed to the legislature, not to the courts, the best way to remedy victims' violations. What you suggest, Your Honor, would be a one remedy. But what the legislature did is entirely reasonable. And we interpret constitutional amendments, including by what happened right afterwards. This was the implementing legislation. This is what the legislature Your Honor.
So I just wanted to suggest to you that perhaps if this exercise of legislative authority is found to be a violation of the separation of powers, that there are other potential remedies that the legislature could adopt.
I would hope so, Your Honor.
Your red light is on, but I want you to think about this because I want to know your answer when you come up for rebuttal. The section of the Constitution says the legislature shall provide remedies for the violation of this section. Don't you have to interpret the words timely disposition of the case in order to first determine whether there's been a violation? So you don't need to answer me, but I'm bringing you back to where I started you from, and I'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Are you prepared? Please.
May it please the Court. My name is Attorney Patrick J. Fiedler, and along with Attorney Timothy Barber, we represent Judge William M. Gabler, Sr. in this case. We're here today because an executive branch agency interfered in an ongoing criminal case and sanctioned a judge because it disagreed with his legal reasoning when he made a routine discretionary scheduling decision that is made every day by circuit judges in this state. Judge Gabler's scheduling decision was consistent with, first of all, his authority to control his own calendar, and second, his duty to be in a position to properly sentence a defendant. Now, crime victims have certain rights in Wisconsin, and that is not at all at issue in this case. What is at issue is the authority of the Crime Victims' Rights Board over judges who are accused of violating those rights. This was a single case with multiple counts, counts involving sexual assault of one victim and of a different victim. There is also a fifth charge there as it relates to drug charge, which is not really an issue here. Judge Gabler had granted the defense motion to sever the cases for trial. That did not make it two cases. So the first case was tried. The defendant was found guilty. Approximately a week after that, a scheduling conference is held. The state then asked that Judge Gabler sentence the defendant on the single conviction while the other counts remain pending.
Counselor, if I could.
Certainly.
I think you did a very good job of lining out the factual background, the procedural background, and the briefing. I wonder if you might be able to respond to Solicitor General Zaitlin's argument that this is a shared power realm.
Yes. Well, what I found interesting about that was, and this with all due respect to opposing counsel, but if I understood his argument correctly, he's taking the position that the Crime Victims' Rights Board has the authority to reprimand the Supreme Court, and that the remedy then the Supreme Court could seek would be a Chapter 227 proceeding, which is Judge Gabler has done in this case. Of course, Chapter 220 proceedings start off in circuit court, which would mean we'd have a situation where a circuit court judge is then making a decision as it relates to actions by the Supreme Court. I understand as it relates to shared powers, et cetera, but I think we're back to the point you were making earlier about core powers, which are the authority of a judge to control his calendar, which relates to judicial review by the appellate courts, and which relates to judicial discipline by the Supreme Court. And however we phrase what occurred in this case, I can only look at this as being a disciplinary proceeding that was brought by a branch, executive branch agency.
Does Judge Gabler understand himself to have been reprimanded?
Most definitely. There's no question in that regard. We can talk in terms of whatever phrase you want to use. I use the statutory phrase, report and recommendation. I'll concede he was not specifically mentioned there, but that is a public record. His name became public record, if it wasn't known already beyond those who are aware of this case, when he exercised his right to file a Chapter 227 petition, because that's not the type of thing that he can do anonymously. And so, yes, he very much feels like he was sanctioned. This is a situation, you got a report and recommendation. Going forward, how could any judge not in Gabler's position not be looking over his shoulder as it relates to decisions he's making on scheduling, wondering, okay, is this in some way going to offend the Crime Victims' Rights Board?
Well, I think, counsel, what you were about to point out when you were reciting some of the facts is something that's gone unsaid here. And I think what I hear you arguing is that Judge Gabler was faced with a bit of a Hobson's choice here, and that being between having the comprehensive information that he would need to make the most knowing sentencing determination, the phase that you were referring to, the first phase of the trial involved a victim, KL, but then allegations in regard to KH were outstanding. And Judge Gabler took the position to say, before sentencing the defendant on the KL matters, I want to know the outcome of KH so that I can make the most knowing, most fair sentencing determination that I can make. And that was the reason, as I understand it, for the delay in the sentencing.
That is correct, Your Honor, and that is consistent with this Court's ruling, starting with McCleary back in 1971, continuing through to Galleon in 2004, and most recently in the Fry case in 2012.
And you're indicating under the reference to those cases, including Galleon, that Judge Gabler, well, under Galleon, he has the lawful obligation to sentence as far as the severity of the conduct, the need to protect the public, and the other lawful considerations under Galleon, which he's trying to give life to, while at the same time trying to balance his responsibilities under the victims' rights legislation, which the record indicates, I believe, that Judge Gabler gave full articulation to his knowledge of victims' rights, his responsibilities under victims' rights, and the reasons for his delay.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that was certainly a Hobson's choice, and I would suggest he faced another Hobson's choice when back on June 25, 2012, he received a letter from the Office of Crime Victim Services, received it in ex parte capacity related to a case which was pending, and did what I think every other circuit judge would do in that situation, is first of all review the Supreme Court rules on that, secondly call Jim Alexander, then the Executive Director of Judicial Commission, and say, here's the situation I have. Am I even allowed to respond to this?
That was the letter urging him to go on with sentencing in the KL matter?
That is correct. And you got to consider when
Did he file that letter in the court file?
That letter, yes, it's dated June 19th, 2012. He received it on June 25th.
And it was filed in the file?
Yes.
Of this case that was
part of the administrative
because
record.
Otherwise it's an ex parte communication that's not revealed.
Right.
So, okay.
Okay.
All right. I was going to ask you, your private counsel, you were appointed by the Director of State Court's office, I assume.
That is correct.
And being paid by the state.
Through the Director of State Court's office.
Yeah. And I was looking for the provision that I remembered, and maybe it's no, I'm remembering it wrong, that says that when a judge is disciplined, the state does not give them counsel and pay for it when the judge is up for discipline. You know what I'm talking about?
I am not familiar with that. I apologize. I do, and though
all
in
right.
this...
I'll find it, and then I'll... we'll read it, assuming I do find it. Because the point of my questioning is, if this were a discipline case, he would have to provide his own counsel. By the fact that it's you are here and being paid by the state would indicate it's not a discipline case. Now, where it fits, I don't know. But I'm just putting that out on the record.
And I appreciate that. And I guess you... I'm looking at this through the eyes of Judge Gabler. Starting off with this ex parte contact, wondering how to deal with this on a pending criminal matter, ultimately make a decision after consulting with the Judicial Commission that a response would be appropriate, and then subsequently being advised by the Crime Victims' Rights Board that he shall respond to an allegation made that he violated crime victims' rights, and then going forward on that as it relates to eventually obtaining counsel, briefs being filed, et cetera. And, you know, this is not a cheap shot, but what I find interesting here is it starts off with Judge Gabler first becoming aware of this in June of 2012. His writ of certiorari action, or Chapter 227, I believe, was filed it would have had to have been filed in August of 2012. They received the final briefing from us, that is the Crime Victims' Rights Board. It was either February or March of 2013. We heard nothing for months until July 24, 2013, where they denied our motion to dismiss and our motion for an evidentiary hearing. And then 2 days later, when they came out with their decision, which was quite lengthy, criticizing Judge Gabler as it relates to facts, as it relates to his interpretation of law. And so that was a lengthy period of time, simply illustrating, I think, that it takes time sometimes to come up with a decision.
Well, I suppose, counsel, that in a way, whether this should be styled as a disciplinary matter is going to be part of our determination for the reason that you alluded to earlier at the beginning of your presentation, which would be that judges all over the state know that they have the lawful obligation and, in fact, can be reversed. And I assume that the defendant in this matter was facing perhaps decades of imprisonment.
I cannot remember exactly what the class felonies were, but they were felonies.
Several decades, I would imagine, and especially if the KH matter went forward. And so whether judges in the state, as you said, your phrase was have to look over their shoulder when they're trying to fulfill their obligation under Galleon and the other cases involving sentencing, and they're trying to do that and avoid, and first of all, be fair. That's what judges are about. But second of all, to avoid reversal for not having fulfilled their lawful obligation to consider all of the factors, while at the same time remaining within compliance with victims' rights. And so really it's a matter that all of our circuit court judges would be looking to us for guidance on, I would imagine.
Well, absolutely, particularly as it relates to who is determining factually what is a violation of a timely disposition of the Constitution and a speedy disposition of the statute. Is that something we're leaving up to an executive branch agency, or is that more properly decided by the Supreme Court?
Well, my ears perk up when people are referring to this as purely a scheduling matter. Scheduling, of course, can encompass any number of things. It can encompass vacation time. It can encompass illness. But here, it's scheduling for the purpose in, as you say, looking at it through Judge Gabler's eyes or any circuit court judge's eyes, of how do I fulfill my lawful obligations and my moral obligations to sentence on the most comprehensive amount of information I can have before me, while at the same time fulfilling my obligations under victims' rights.
And it raised a potential anomaly. I realized that there is case law indicating that in determining a proper sentence, a court can consider such things as pending charges, consider prior charges result in acquittal, but that's an individual choice made by a judge. It is not mandatory to consider that. Potentially, you would have a situation here.
And it should be considered, but I believe there's case law that says it is not conclusive.
Exactly.
It is to be something that the pending charges, the dismissed counts, counts that haven't even been charged may be considered, but they are not to be the determinative, as opposed to something that actually goes through trial and results in either convictions or acquittal.
Absolutely. And what if it happened in this situation? Let's assume that Judge Gabler had changed his mind after this ex parte contact. Of course, he'd have to notify counsel on both sides as to the existence of this letter, et cetera, bring them in for a hearing, give them the opportunity to respond, and then make a decision as far as are we going to go ahead with the sentencing prior to the second trial or not. Let's assume he did that and had the sentencing on the single conviction involving the one victim, and then cited, well, you also have a pending charge of sexual assaults against a totally different victim. And obviously this reflects poorly upon your character. And it's something, as part of many reasons, certainly that Judge Gabler would consider and state on the record in imposing sentence. What if on the second trial, the defendant's acquitted? What do you do in that type of situation? Certainly would be a basis for a motion for resentencing on the first count. I think what every circuit judge attempts to do in this state, and obviously it involves making decisions several times on a daily basis, is handle each case, whether it's a small claims case or a medical malpractice or products liability or homicide or sexual assault, as being important, because it's important to all the parties involved in the case. And when we talk in terms of delay, to me that means circuit court judges attempt to put together what I call a complete package. When I was on the bench, I assumed every case I was handling was going to go up on appeal. Because in this state, if you want to, it's automatic. You can go to the Court of Appeals. And so what I wanted to do was make certain that I had done everything that I could do on that case. So when it went up to the appellate court, hopefully it was not going to come back with directions that I missed something, do an evidentiary hearing, do the following, et cetera.
Counsel, I want to shift your focus a little bit before we spend more time on this.
Is he done, done with answering that question?
He was talking about what he did as a judge. So that's what I moved him away from.
Okay.
I don't think that's overly relevant. But in any case, one of the things that the board relied on in their decision was WSSTAT 971-105. And I personally found that troublesome because it comes in a chapter that deals with proceedings before and at trial. And the part they relied on was that the judge was to ensure a speedy trial. Well, what the whole sentence says is the court and the district attorney shall take appropriate action to assure a speedy trial in order to minimize the length of the time the child must endure the stress of the child's involvement in the proceeding. And what I'd like you to comment on is, does that statute have any relevance to provisions that involve sentencing when it comes out of a chapter where the proceedings are before trial and at trial?
I do not believe it does. And most recently, and I apologize, this is not in my brief, but in May, I believe, was of last year, 2016, U.S. Supreme Court came out with Betterman v. Montana, which is 136 Supreme Court 1609. The holding there is that the Sixth Amendment speedy trial guarantee protects the accused from arrest or indictment through trial, but does not apply once the defendant has been found guilty at trial or has pleaded guilty to criminal charges, and thus does not apply to the sentencing phase of a criminal prosecution.
Right. And I was looking at it. I'm not familiar with Betterman, but as I read the results and the findings of the board, because the circuit court is, you know, that's not who we review. We review what the board did. And one of the last things was that they relied on 97105 saying that Judge Gaedler clearly violated that. And I thought, to me, if you were interpreting that from the beginning, if that involves sentencing, we have a different chapter on sentencing. Why would the provision be in the chapter before and at trial? So I'm happy for your cite to Betterman. I will read that. Thank you.
I find it interesting that we've rushed to the constitutional issue, because the ordinary procedure in a court or the ordinary concept is you don't get to constitutional issues when you have some statutory issues, of which you have some here, right? Procedural issues. The statute that I was referring to about attorney fees is 757.99, which you don't have to look at now, but that is the indication that if we're in a discipline proceeding, which should be in the Judicial Commission, you pay for your own lawyer if you happen to be acquitted. I use the word acquitted because it's easier for me. Then you can sue the state and try and get money back for that, and that's what 757.99 says. I just want to clarify some points. Could the victim have intervened in this case before Judge Gaedler and said, sentence him now?
Potentially by, as Justice Kelly was suggesting, a writ of mandamus.
Okay, but writ of mandamus is kind of, you got to have a plain, clear duty, and not rather than discretionary on mandamus, on the elements. And counsel for the state ought to consider that in answering the questions. So whether there's a sentence that took too long to do is not so clear. First of all, we're not due delay. Delay doesn't cover. Speedy trial doesn't cover this, right? The sentencing.
It does not.
Does not. So now you've got discretion whether or not how long it takes. You have even discretion in speedy trial, because that can be not so speedy, right?
Correct.
So how can you get mandamus? You think you can go into any trial court and say to the judge now with mandamus, you got a sentence in 2 months, 1 month, 5 months?
You can certainly make that suggestion. It's still going to be a matter of discretion for the trial court to decide.
That's right. So it's hard to get mandamus on a discretionary matter. That's not an element in mandamus, is it?
No.
All right. Can the legislature or a joint legislative committee investigate, when I say investigate, I'll try and make it more neutral, review trial court decisions in the state to determine how long it's taking judges to do sentencing after a conviction, because they may be interested in pre-sentencing reports, whether they are done timely, right?
They can certainly investigate that, anybody can investigate that.
Right. So the legislature can and can get records from the trial court?
It's all open record.
Yeah. So, and then they can come out with a report that says in Adams County, here's the deal, and the judge in Adams County is, and say, oh, it took too long in Adams County. I don't think anyone's here from Adams County. That's why I picked that. So that can be done. So why can't they delegate that?
Well, I think what you're talking about here is a situation where this legislative committee
Mm-hmm.
is looking at the situation, and something comes to my mind by way of analogy. In the past, the Wisconsin Law Journal has looked at circuit court judges and during a particular year what their percentage was on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this is all public record. There's nothing to keep the legislative committee from looking at this. I think the difference here is what the Crime Victims Rights Board has done.
Well, can't they issue a report saying that the judges in the following counties took too long in sentence in
there'd be nothing to stop them from doing that.
And that they can name the judge, they can issue a report and recommendation.
Correct.
Why can't they delegate to the board to do that? Now, I have a real problem on reprimand because I think that's covered under the Constitution under Section 11.
Now, you got to understand this from the standpoint of when they start their initial, and they didn't even do an investigation. They relied improperly upon everything the Crime Victim Services Office had done. And they're not allowed to do an investigation until they make a finding of probable cause. But once they've made the finding of probable cause, there's no reason to do an investigation because they've got the material submitted by Crime Victim Services. So, but at the outset here, if you're talking about Judge Gabler having to answer the Crime Victims Rights Board, clearly what the statute says they can do, has the authority to do, A, issue public and private reprimands, B, only as to judges, refer to the Judicial Commission, C, seek appropriate equitable relief, I'm not certain what that is, and D, bring civil actions to assess a forfeiture, I believe it's up to $1,000. Language in that statute then goes on to say also may issue reports and recommendations. But you have to put this in context. You've got to take a step back here and look at the situation Judge Gabler was in on this pending case in terms of, okay, I've got the Crime Victims Rights Board issuing this report and recommendation critical of what I have done. Does that mean going forward, I'm going to have to, in addition to doing all my duties as a judge, appease whatever feelings they may have about how I should handle a case?
Well, doesn't the judge, first of all, I would hope, in terms of judicial independence, that the judge does what the judge thinks is the right thing to do under the statutes and the Constitution, regardless of whether the media is going to be critical of the judge, regardless of whether the board is going to be critical of the judge, and regardless of whether this court's going to be critical of what the judge did. The judge is supposed to follow the law and not worry about whether he's going to be criticized. So I favor doing everything possible to ensure that the judges act that way. That's my principle. I'm for that. I think you are, as a former judge, are, and that's what this case is about. But the judge is subject to criticism, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So now, where's the line between those two things?
Here's the line, because that language about issuing reports and recommendations is contained in the statute as it relates to discretionary authority which the legislature has given the Crime Victims Rights Board as it applies to judges in the state. The state has now indicated that goes all the way up to this court. Okay? So that's, to me, an official sanction. You know, as it relates to what's in the paper, can a circuit judge be upset about it? Absolutely. One of the things that certain circuit judges are concerned about, well, you know, my actions here were reported. Was it put in the proper context as far as why I made this decision, that type of thing? But that's something that everybody who's in public life has to live with.
Exactly.
But it's different when you're talking about this agency as part of the executive branch, which basically, I think in this case, has taken the position, we're going to interpret the law as to timely disposition, speedy disposition.
Agencies can interpret the law.
Well,
they do it all the time.
As it relates to judges?
Pardon me?
As it relates to judges?
No.
Hey, what is the composition of this board?
During the time in question, which we are taking as 2012 to 2014, was the district attorney, to my knowledge, that was the only member of the board that had a law degree. It was a sheriff. I think it was a victim rights advocate, and then two other people with no designation other than, I'm just going to call them lay people.
Members of the public.
Members of the public, thank you.
Is there any provision specifying what categories of people must make up the board?
You know, I apologize, Justice Bradley. I did not consider that. I don't know if it's mandated you have a sheriff and a district attorney and a victim advocate or not. I don't know.
Do you know whether a judge has ever been a member of this board or a retired judge?
To the best of my knowledge, once this case was totally away from the Crime Victims Rights Board, I believe that former Dane County Circuit Judge Rebecca St. John was appointed to the Crime Victims Rights Board. I don't know if she's still there, but if she is still there, during her tenure, she had absolutely nothing to do with this case.
When would you agree that Judge Gableman interpreted both the constitutional provision...
Gabler.
Thank you very much. I did that once before. Thank you. That he interpreted both the constitutional provision and the portions of the victim rights law that are at issue before us in regard to the timeliness or the speediness of the disposition.
Correct.
Okay. Are you familiar with any place where a circuit court judge interprets a statute or a constitutional provision and an administrative agency has the authority to overrule the interpretation that he's made?
None whatsoever, because that authority is vested solely in the appellate courts of the state.
Right. Thank you.
But a trial court in this state has authority only in that county, not elsewhere. And we said that in one of our cases. I don't remember if it was a John Doe case, but we said that the order of the Dane County Circuit Court, you may remember this better than I, Judge Fiedler, that when the trial court in Dane County issued an order, it didn't bind, I think, the AG's office and other offices outside of Dane County. Found them only in Dane County. So if the board says something, or the trial court in Eau Claire says something, it doesn't bind the whole state. And if there was a ruling in, take an alert case, and the trial court made a ruling on it, would it bind alert in every other case in this state?
No, my reaction to that would be it would not.
It would not. That's my reaction. And are you trying to tell the court that an administrative agency has no authority to say that they think that the judge may have violated, issue a report? I wouldn't, anything further than that, we'd get a problem. Issue a report that the judge's actions were violative of a victim's right.
All right, I'm not certain I understand the...
Well, I'm asking you, are you saying that this court has to say victims, this board has no authority over judges, period? Is that your position?
No. The Crime Victims' Rights Board, it's constitutional for the Crime Victims' Rights Board to refer matters to the Judicial Commission.
Oh, but but they can't issue a report.
Well, in this type of situation, again, I want to differentiate here between what a legislative committee says in their report, which I can't imagine having any binding effect on a particular circuit judge. Only the Supreme Court can do that, as opposed to this Crime Victims' Rights Board executive branch agency issuing this report and recommendation. What I am back to is I don't see any judge in Judge Gabler's position can go forward without worrying about, I want to make this decision because I know it's the right thing to do, but what if yet there's another report and recommendation indicating that I was wrong again? I mean, Judge Gabler recognizes he answers to this court on matters of judicial review, on matters of judicial discipline, and that's what starts with the Constitution.
So the judge can be reviewed by this commission, this board, as I understand your response to me. It's just that they can't issue a report that says he's screwed up, to use the technical term.
Not because...
But that they can just refer to the commission, to the Judicial Commission. Is that your position?
My red light is on. May I answer that question just a second?
Yes, please, briefly.
That is my position, clearly.
That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Solicitor General, did you remember my question? And if you did, would you start with that, please?
I did, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'd like to make 3 points, the first one being responding to your question.
Thank you.
Of course, executive branch agencies interpret law all the time. It is within the Victims' Rights Board authority to interpret the constitutional and statutory phrase speedy disposition. The reason we know that is the legislature specifically assigned them the authority to interpret that phrase. That is why the interpretation here that led to the report of recommendation was entirely appropriate and entirely consistent with the legislature's delegated authority over a statute, which happens all the time with executive agencies.
Right, but in this case, they interpreted speedy disposition to include sentencing.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And the circuit court did not, and as I understand from opposing counsel, the Supreme Court has now said it doesn't include sentencing, and WSSTAT 971.095 was relied on by the board, which appears in a chapter that says before and at trial, so, and also applies to the DA.
The Betterman case specifically focused on the text and the constitution of the statute with regard to speedy trial rights of the accused. What the Supreme Court said is they're no longer accused once they've been convicted. That has absolutely nothing to do with the speedy disposition rights of victims, which under the catch-all statutory phrase in the Victims' Bill of Rights, not the one you relied on.
Well, the 971.095, the board relied on in either their last paragraph or the paragraph before, and that's the provision that comes out of proceedings before and at trial, and it is a speedy trial provision that does apply to child victims.
Even if you are correct, Your Honor, with regard to that particular provision, it is very clear, I think, that the constitutional right to speedy disposition and the statutory right in 950.041VK, which is in the Victims' Bill of Rights, clearly applies to victims of sentencing. And that segues to...
Why is it clear?
Because it implies to the disposition of the case. The case is not over until there is a sentence. And that relates to the second point I wanted to make, which is to respond to Justice Gableman's point. With respect, the judge here did not give any respect to victims' rights during the January 18th conference. As I started my presentation, the linchpin of the judge's decision was, I quote, the victim doesn't have rights at this time because she is, quote, under no greater or less stress having the sentence delayed.
You misapprehend my question to Judge Fiedler. My question had to do whether the judge, Judge Gabler, disregarded the law, not that you and I are going to engage in a subjective discussion about whether he gave due deference under the law, but whether he recognized his obligations, gave recognition, expressed recognition. Do you understand the distinction?
Right, Your Honor.
That is the point of my question. So you just set up a perfect spot for me to ask, what do you advise judges to do who are trying to follow their lawful obligation to sentence according to the case law that has been set out by this court, while at the same time honoring the rights of victims under victims' rights legislation? It is per se, if the victim moves for sentencing, then the judge, in your estimation, is it your estimation then, your opinion, that the judge has the automatic duty to sentence?
Your Honor, I don't want to be seen as avoiding a question, but I want to give a pre-answer.
I'll make it real simple. What should he have done?
Your Honor, the reasoning that he gave on the January 18th conference, which is
I know what you're saying.
That reasoning, well, if I may, Your Honor, and I will answer your question, I promise. So the reasoning he gave was that the victim had no rights to sentencing. That is all the board reviewed. That is under this court's Hartung decision, 1981, when a discretionary decision is made. That reasoning given by the district, by the circuit court, is all that's reviewed. However, if the judge had given the reason that he later gave in his submission, I think that would have also been a legal error. It is very clear under the precedence of this court, as acknowledged by my friend on the other side, that a judge can consider pending charges, that a judge can consider even acquitted conduct. And when you have something as weighty as victims' rights, when you have a constitutional right for speedy disposition, the preference for more information cannot overcome a six-month delay subjecting a child victim of sexual assault to 6 months of stress.
So
that is not sufficient.
Your answer to my question is yes.
That's correct, Your Honor, but
Thank
that...
You.
But that is not what the board's decision is based upon. The board's decision is based upon the conclusion that the reasons given at the January 18th conference were not legally sufficient, and that is correct.
Thank you, Justice. If I might make, ask a question.
Well, quickly, because we want to be fair to both sides here.
Indeed. There's been some discussion about what the board actually did in this case and that all it did was issue a report. I'd like to turn your attention to page 147 of your appendix, the document that begins there, goes many pages, and it is captioned Final Decision and Order. Do you see that?
Yes.
When was that issued?
I see that. What is your question, Your Honor?
When was that issued?
That was issued on the same day as the report and recommendation. The date is at the end of the document.
And paragraphs 14 through 27 of that document comprise an analysis of what Judge Gabler did and found through findings of fact and conclusions of law that he violated the victim's constitutional rights.
Correct? That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So that's a little more than a report.
No, Your Honor. That was the finding of violation. And that as a remedy, the court at the end says, we're only going to issue one remedy here. We're going to issue a report. We're not going to go the higher step of issuing a reprimand.
And
so reprimands are not an issue in this case.
Is this not a reprimand simply because it does not contain that word?
No, that is exactly right, Your Honor. And in fact, in the circumstance that this court is much more familiar with, the Judicial Commission, there are sanctions less than reprimands. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you both for good arguments and excellent briefs in something that's really a difficult case for many reasons. The issues are complicated. The issues are new. And so we all appreciate it when your briefs are as fine as they were, and they were very, very good. It helps us out a ton, even though we do our own research. And the arguments were spirited, as usual, which always makes it fun for everyone. So thank you so much. We are adjourned. The court will meet in closed conference at 10 minutes after...